She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And Happy New Year, everybody. This is the first show of the new year. I honestly could not be more excited about our guest, more concerned about the topic that we're going to be discussing. And I want to give a shout out to the Chapman Automotive Group. Our sincere thanks for their ongoing support since day one. So thank you, Chapman, and all for all the good stuff you do to help make this possible and for everything you do for the community. And I hope everybody listening is excited about 2015 as we are in the Mrs. Green team, and that you're ready to pump up the volume with us in our commitment to growing this wonderful global community of people who care about this great planet of ours. So the topic for the show today is, what is a GMO and why should I care? And if there is one topic that I am obsessed about, this would be it, truly. Our guest today, I don't think there's a person more capable of helping us understand this very complex and such controversial issue. Joining me in studio, and with a very long introduction that I already apologized to him for, but I have to do it to establish your credibility, my friend, is Dr. Jim Gentile. He is the Dean for Natural and Applied Sciences at Hope College in Holland, Michigan, and is the past president of Research Corporation for Science Advancement, a Tucson-based Arizona foundation, Arizona-based foundation dedicated to science since 1912. I think it's the oldest foundation, period.
It's the second oldest foundation. Carnegie Foundation is older. However, it is the oldest continuous for science and only science foundation in the U.S.
So that's big. Lots of people in Tucson never even heard of it. But on with the intro. I already digress. A geneticist by training, Jim has conducted extensive research on the role of metabolism in the conversion of natural, and is it Xenobiotic agents into mutagens and carcinogens. I'm only going to say that once. With funding from organizations like the National Institute of Health, the National Science Foundation, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and the World Health Organization. So he's playing with the big dogs among many other public and private foundation. He's the author of more than 1,500 research articles, and I think that I wrote in my write-up for you for the show, thousands. So a little hyperbole there, but it's probably thousands. 150 research articles, book chapters, book reviews, and special reports in the areas of scientific research and higher education. And believe me when I say he's a frequent speaker on issues involving the integration of scientific research and higher education. And last but certainly not least, Jim is a very dear friend of ours who has truly supported me on this journey and helped me understand somewhat this very complex issue. So if that didn't embarrass you, let's get on with the show. And
yeah.
You deserve a big, big introduction. So let's start with the simple question of, what is a genetically modified organism, and is it the same as a genetically engineered organism? Are the two interchangeable? So what's a GMO?
What a GMO is, an organism that would have genes inserted, have had genes inserted into it, that wouldn't necessarily come across through a common cross within the species or common biology. So there's has to be some artificial mechanism of moving the gene in. It could be a gene insertion. It could be using nanoparticles to move a gene containing other genes into it. But an artificial, non-normally sexual, or even asexual distribution of genes.
And so when you say that to me in the science speak, as I refer to it, I understand that. Inherently not bad, been happening for a long time. not bad, not controversial. Is that a true statement?
It's a very true statement. One can take a look at different kinds of crosses. And sometimes if you take a look, for example, if you want to cross cross different species of corn or different, right. not species of corn, but different strains of
right.
corn. If you want to cross different breeds of animals, different breeds of dogs, one can do that very comfortably and easily. We can get hybrids. For example, you have a horse and a donkey and you get a mule.
Yes.
And so there's a
there
lot
you
of,
go.
There's a lot of natural modifications that can occur through what I would call normal sexuality or asexuality based distribution of genes.
So in the growing controversy, in the really loud noise that's starting to happen in international media, certainly not just in American media, the belief systems and the narrative matter, as far as I'm concerned, and what clearly are growing concerns about GMOs. What do Americans need to think about in terms of our views on GMOs versus organic crops? You talk about cognitive dissonance or whirling dervish brain. What do Americans need to think about in terms of our views about GMOs? What should we tell us, not what to think, but what we should be thinking about? Big question.
No, it is a big question. And I think one of my concerns isn't relative to GMO specifically, but it's really relative to the public. And I'm not talking only about the American public.
Right.
Let's just talk about the world public.
Right.
Not understanding science, not taking the time to understand the science behind something, and therefore just letting it happen. I think the same thing can go for scientists. We can talk in science speak, and we can throw jargon out, and we can find different mechanisms to justify and argue what we do. And we can do it in a language that absolutely bores everybody else
the
in the
general
world to
public,
death.
It's like the blank stare comes on. Like, what the heck are they talking about? It's science as a second language, and I don't get it.
That's right. And so I'm very worried, just to move off of GMO for a second, for example, the lack of understanding what's happening in climate change.
Right.
And the lack of, and the argument as to whether climate change is really something that is human created, which it is, or it's just going to happen anyway, so don't worry about it, or it's not happening at all, because this is just a cycle that we're going through on the earth. Well, GMOs is an example of something that is human created. Doesn't make it bad, but then it does allow us to take a look at, well, what really is the outcome that's going to be benefiting all things on earth that are alive, as well as benefiting the earth itself. And then what are the, what can I say? What are the risks we're willing to take
right, right.
to accomplish those good goals?
Right.
Because almost everything is risk. One of the things that I had the opportunity to do with the Environmental Protection Agency a number of years ago was to sit on panels that would do risk assessment. And you would take a look and you would say, okay, so there's 90% probability this is really good and nothing is going to happen.
Right.
But you know, there's about a 10% chance of risk. Is that risk acceptable based on the common good that's going to occur? That's an example of a risk assessment. And I think that's the kind of thing that one needs to be thinking of then relative to anything in the environment, and then particularly GMOs in the environment.
And when you say that to me, it's like, you know, the tagline for the show is, we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. Do you think that the growing, the noise in this country about GMOs, and I don't want to call it noise, it's a very topical issue. There are initiatives in, I think, 30 states to have, you know, stop GMOs. Where do they look for what I would call some modicum of truth? Because what you have are the anti-GMO people, and they're bad, 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 bad. And then you have the big money, that's saying they're good, 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 and they're going to solve world hunger, and they're going to help us with all these droughts, and they're going to basically feed the world. When you advise people, I go to you. I mean, that sounds really kind of funny and cliche.
Wow, but you being a minority.
I do. but I have to go to somebody you trust, which is why I asked you to be on the show. So when you're looking at that, when you say that people need to be digging a little bit deeper, is it just a matter of Googling it and reading both sides to some in some depth and getting some of your own answers?
I that's a tough question.
It's a really tough question for me.
Google starts with a G, and so does gospel. And I think in both cases, one can question what you find, and there's really very, very little authenticated authority that you would get out of a Google search. But you would get a sense of a community. You can get a sense of the preponderance of information on X, Y, or Z seems to weigh in one direction or the other. I think that's one thing. I think that it would really be of value, particularly for educators, and this goes all the way down to educating young children, to help inform people in various ways. If you're going to ask a question, how can you find all of the evidence to that question, whatever it might be? And to if you want to listen to people talking, I'm probably the anti-Rush Limbaugh, but that doesn't mean Rush
Limbaugh.
Which
is a really good fit for our show.
but that doesn't mean that Rush Limbaugh doesn't have some good things to say at various points. And so how do you sort the wheat from the chaff?
Yeah.
And I think that that's really one of the complicated things. And sadly, that gets back to whenever it gets technical, people shy away from it and they defer to the loudest voice. That could be the loudest protesting voice, and that could be the loudest affirmation voice.
Right, right.
You know, genetics has been going on an awful long time. We're all a product of it. Actually, we do genetic engineering, if you think about it, in mate selection.
Yes, yes, you're right.
And who we choose to mate with is a thing relative to the
Gene pool.
The gene pool, but it's the phenotype of the gene pool we become attracted to.
Right.
And then when we, in genetic terms, make this cross, and we produce of F1, a filial generation, first generation, that child is going to have a combination of genes.
And that brings it down to the really understandable level.
And really that is a genetically engineered organism in a natural pathway.
That's right. And let's hope that that continues in the path in which it has been since the beginning of time. Okay, let's go back to... Let's talk about America versus the rest of the world. Where do we, it seems to me, from my research and my G word, Googling it, that we are kind of lone wolves on this, that other countries throughout Europe and the rest of the world are taking a very precautionary approach in terms of the introduction of GMOs or genetically engineered crops. America, you know, I'm from Jersey, so I'm going to say forget about it. We're just going full on. Are we the lone wolf? You travel the globe. Where do we sit?
I don't think we're the lone wolf necessarily, but I think we're the big dog wolf. And part of that is because the impact, the agricultural nature of our country and the ability to grow food in huge proportions,
right,
and
right,
distribute food in huge proportions, is you almost uniquely
it
North
is.
American.
We're epic,
and where one has some other concerns and situations. I mean, a really good example is one we've talked about is that some of the genetically engineered organisms, maize, for example. Really have genes put into them to limit the ability of the seeds to be sterile. So they're sterility now, and they can't replant the next crop out of the existing crop. And that's affecting places like India.
How is that not awful?
And
I mean, that may sound like a simplification, but how is that not awful? So basically what you're saying in plain English is, these seeds will last one season.
These seeds will last.
Then they're done.
And you had better make enough money on your crop.
Talk about messing with Mother Nature.
But if your crop is to feed a family or a small village, then there's no money in there, and you have to come up with the resources to buy seeds again for the next year. That's taking many small farmers, even in the U.S., many small farmers are going out of business. But in places like India and in other areas of Southeast Asia and in other countries, there's people actually just going not only out of business, but suicides and the inability to feed the family. The loss of face in many countries is tremendous. Here we just call it embarrassment, but it's actually a huge social issue in many countries.
It's such a different dynamic when there are literally still caste systems and you're born into this and you do this and this is what has been the deal. It's not, I'm going to go get another job or I'm going to, you know, get a degree in this. This is our life.
That's exactly
right.
They're
killing themselves.
When you also take a look at the organic movement, not just the anti-GMO, the organic movement is a positive way of thinking about that. And then you travel to an area, let's say Switzerland, where there are no GMOs allowed.
Right.
And the foods, everyone says, my gosh, it's expensive here. I'm afraid that in the U.S. we're not willing to pay the expense that it would take to go back and have crops that are more and more susceptible to some of the various environmental effects that might wipe out a crop. So now what we're getting are cheaper foods. One can verify that by going to an organic grocery store and going to your local Walmart grocery store and take a look at the prices for X, whatever X is. And you'll find that it's far more expensive to grow things in an organic nature because you don't have the volume. And you have to have the care, and you have to put other things into those crops to ensure that they come out available for the public to use and purchase.
But I think it begs the question, and you brought in the big dogs. We're going to talk about the big dogs. We're going to talk about what I call the M word, Monsanto, in one of the segments. But when you talk about the money, if you're a small farmer in India, converting to an organic farm, almost beyond impossible without outside help. It costs so much money. But if you are a big dog making literally billions of dollars in profits, isn't there the ability to make a compelling argument for the possibility exists that there could be a stronger shift toward organic? Does that make sense? Let's just say it. Okay, Mrs. Green, couldn't Monsanto really move that needle forward, but it would affect earnings per share?
Sure. Any company can do that.
It's like, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Not to pick on Monsanto, but they're just really good at what they do. And to be honest with you, from an experimental standpoint, as an experimental scientist, I do move genes around.
Right.
And they aren't for the public consumption. It's because it's a way, if you take a gene and you put it in a different background, you can understand the impact of that gene on a whole organism. And that tells you something then about not just the genetics, it tells you something about the physiology and helps one move in a variety of directions. And if I needed to do an insertion, I would ask colleagues that I have at Monsanto if they would help me do that because they're darn good at it.
And you just wouldn't tell me. I'm only kidding.
Well, doing it in a laboratory is different.
Right. It's very different.
Doing it for the commercial enterprise.
And I just think it's a big mistake to totally demonize Monsanto. I mean, I like to. It's easy. They're just such a big target. But I think that you have convinced me there are other sides to look at. We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I think there are other things that we really and truly need to think about. You know, when we come back, I want to get down to some simple things that you have taught me about GMOs. For example, is it going to hurt me if I eat crops from them? Does it have a human impact on me? If something is Roundup ready, does that mean, you know, I wrote an article once about saying I am not a GMO, I am not a pesticide. So I think the public, my friends, people that I've had, you know, the blessing to interact with, those are complex questions that I think you can bring, shed some light on about what we're going
sure.
to, the future of GMOs. I mean, they're not going away. So everybody, stay here with me. We have a lot more to talk about in terms of what is a GMO and why should I care? And of course, I believe care we should. Stay tuned for more with Dr. Jim Gentile from Hope College. We'll be right back. Stay here with me. Think blue. Think beyond green. Think TDI clean diesel technology. One part of the Volkswagen Think Blue initiative, our goal of creating and encouraging eco-conscious products and behaviors. This is Mrs. Green. A car that can drive a long way should still make you want to, well, drive a long way. Volkswagen Jetta's TDI clean diesel is a high-mileage vehicle that lets you stop at the filling station less often so you can spend more time enjoying the road. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI.
Find everything you need for your next adventure at Bookman Sports Exchange. Buy it new, buy it used, or trade up and go where you've never been before. Explore this big backyard we call Tucson. Bookman Sports Exchange has the gear you need for anything from a quick day hike in Sabino to a long backpacking trip through the Grand Canyon. Bookman Sports Exchange, open daily, located on Speedway, east of Country Club. For details and more information, visit bookmansports.com.
Ready to clean out that garage? Goodwill offers you 40 convenient locations all over southern Arizona. And at every one, you'll be greeted by a uniformed Goodwill employee trained to assist you in unloading your items, prepared to offer you a receipt for your tax-deductible donation, and grateful for something you won't get anywhere else.
Thank you. Because of your donation, I have a job.
The gift of Goodwill. For a list of Goodwill donation sites, go to goodwillsouthernaz.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And just to do a quick shout out to invite you to consider becoming a sustaining member of Mrs. Green's World. Your support will help us to keep broadcasts like this, which are so incredibly important, to keep them free and independent and to continue to bring you informative shows like this one, addressing issues that impact all of our lives. Please visit our website at mrsgreensworld.com. Click on the Preserve Our Planet icon in the upper right-hand corner. And the other reminder in this new year is we have a great app. So much of our listening audience is because of the Igloo app. So I have scientists telling me they're listening to it while they run. I have mothers who are home listening to it while they do the laundry. So we have an app for that. And again, it's on our website. And I invite you to download the free app and enjoy the benefit of all these incredible guests today. So I'd like to welcome back our in-studio guests for today. His name is Dr. Jim Gentile. He is the Dean for Natural and Applied Sciences at Hope College in Holland, Michigan, and the past president of Research Corporation for Science Advancement, a Tucson-based foundation dedicated to science since 1912. And I just have to do a little bit more because I said to him earlier, this is gives you cred. You have instant cred. When I share with our listeners, why did I have Jim Gentile as the premier guest for our 2015 year. Among his many awards, he has received the Alexander Hollander Research Excellent Award from the Environmental Mutagen Society, the Cancer Medallion of the Japanese National Cancer Institute. I mean, I had to bring that up. And the Science Medal of Dedication of Pisa, Italy. There's a whole story about that that I'm sure I want to know about how much fun you had there. He is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a national associate of the National Academies of Science, and a National Academies Education Mentor. And really, at this point, people might stop listening, but we certainly have their attention. This man has a lot of credibility, a lot of information to share with us about genetically modified organisms, good, bad, or indifferent. So let's start with GMOs. Bad or good, and why would we have something, I'm going to leap right to, why would we have something called a lemonado? Like we're messing with Mother Nature. So give us some good examples and bad examples.
Sure. Well, first of all, just the last thing, just, and this will ruin my credibility. I happen to be an avid Chicago White Sox and Chicago Bears fan. So that tells you that my choice in athletic teams.
And a deadhead.
And a deadhead. But well,
age your deadhead.
So now anything I might say can be taken with that grain of salt.
And we promise to have fun, because I'll tell you what, guys, this man may sound serious, but you want to have fun with him too.
So you know, it really all depends. When one thinks about genetics, it all depends upon the genes you move. Moving a gene is inherently not bad.
Okay.
It's a matter of moving a gene for what purpose. That may not even be bad, but one has to be really careful about which genes you move. We have done genetics a long time in agriculture by noticing naturally resistant organisms or naturally resistant crops, and being able to cross them into other backgrounds to see if we can transfer some of the pest resistance that might be there. And those are really good genetically modifying mechanisms. They occur in a natural way. That doesn't mean that having it occur in an industrial mechanism is necessarily bad, but there's always an outcome that has to be weighed against the good. There's always a concern of something. So I'll give you an example of the Lemonado, since we were talking about it when we were off the air. It's a pretty simple-minded one.
What the heck is a Lemonado? I didn't even know that there was such a thing.
Right. So if you take an insertion of a bacillus gene into a tomato, you're going to get a lemongrass aroma from that tomato.
And why?
Because
people like the smell of lemons.
People like the smell. It becomes a fragrant thing to do. It's a natural lemongrassy vegetable.
Right. Sounds sexy. Sounds good.
Nothing bad, right? Except one thing. The only one thing is you have to move something. So the tomato now, in making all of the biochemistry that the tomato does to make this lemongrass aroma and move it along, makes less lycopene, which is what you want to get out of a tomato. Because lycopene has the ability, first of all, it's very healthy to have lycopene. And it also has the ability to be something we call an anti-inflammatory, anti-carcinogen. In a variety of ways, it kind of keeps the housekeeping in your system.
So you've totally messed with the nutritional value.
You've changed it.
You've changed it.
And you're sacrificing then aromas and delicacies for what would be a natural reason why you'd want a lot of tomatoes.
Right. And I love the smell when you cut a fresh tomato open. I love that smell. I'm good with that. I don't want it to smell like lemon fresh zest. I really don't.
That's about what it smells like. I mean, it's not so bad, but that's one of the challenges that's there. And that may not ever affect a person in her life.
Right.
But, it's an example of a trade-off. And almost all of these things are examples of trade-off. You're adding something of value.
Right.
And that's going to mess up the natural order in that organism. And that may be for the good, and it may be for the bad. And so there's always these kinds of things. For example, so an example in corn. You can take a Bacillus thuringiensis, and you can put it into corn. And the good thing about it is that insects are not going to be as capable of infesting that corn. And that means that you're going to save spraying.
Right.
So there's a benefit then of the lack of pesticides, or at least a reduced number of pesticides. The downside?
Of
the need for pesticides.
Because that has been modified, so insects don't like it, they're not going to eat it. And so you've helped to cut that down. Okay, got it.
Except that. That happens to also be the one that's killing the monarch butterflies.
Oh.
And so it's a downside.
So there you go.
And now you need to weigh those things. And I'm not in a position to say which way you should go, but that makes it a really remarkably different thing. It's almost impossible to say then in today's massively produced hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres that any given farm would have, especially in areas in the U.S. Don't spray pesticides and don't put anything that would still keep those plants intact, and don't kill monarchs.
It's almost the pollinators. We need our pollinators.
That's right.
I mean, they're part of the food chain that are being so, you know, a third of them are of honeybees, for example, in the United States have been.
Exactly right. So that becomes a challenge. Now you can take corn again, and you can go back to, you had mentioned Monsanto earlier. So we can take a look at one set of genes that they put into that to make a corn line called Roundup Ready. All right.
It's so much what I want to talk about. Here's my basic question I've been dying to ask you, Jim Gentile. Do I want to eat something and put in my body something that's been labeled Roundup Ready? I wrote an article on it before I knew what I was talking about. So tell us what I'm talking about or what I should be writing about.
Well,
Roundup Ready.
Yeah, Roundup is a very, very common herbicide. For example, you can buy Roundup in most any grocery store. You can buy Roundup in spray cans in any hardware store. And if you're too lazy to bend over and pull the weed that comes up in the cracks in your sidewalk.
Right. Just spray it with a pesticide.
Spray it on Roundup and it'll take care of it. So it's very effective.
It's a killer.
It's a very effective chemical. So Roundup Ready then talks about the fact that you can have the genes inserted, which will allow the plants to be more tolerable of the Roundup. And hence, you can spray a little bit more onto a plot and clear it of all the weeds and all of the other kinds of things that you really, really need to get out of an agricultural field if you're going to do mass harvesting and things like that.
And that's the operative phrase, mass harvesting, because I've had guests on the show where they have organic farms and there are natural, thus more expensive ways. You get the goats in there, you put the birdhouses, you get the chickens.
That's right.
Much more expensive. We're not talking mass production.
So let me just go back to some data, some experiments we had done earlier in our laboratory. We were looking at a particular set of pesticides, not Roundup, but we were looking at other pesticides, cyclic triazines. And it was noticed that cyclic triazines were relatively safe and relatively okay. And so they were used in a wide span. But literally with a couple of colleagues of mine over a lot of beer, this is the way science is done.
Hashtag
folks.
Yes, you wanted to be there.
Yeah, and so we were walking out in the field, and this is in central Illinois, and we're walking along the fields, and we take a look, and here's test plot here, and everyone who's been in the Midwest sees these test plots,
right?
And there's test plot here, and there's herbicide here, X herbicide, Y X, and then there's this other one with no herbicides on it, and we're looking at stuff, and what made us do it, is. History.
The beer. I think it
could
was
have been
the beer.
So all we did was pick up some pollen grains, which you can get pretty easily by going to a plant. We looked at those pollen grains because we were curious about something, and sure enough, we found that there were mutations occurring in the pollen grains of corn plants that were treated with the pesticides.
Right.
But no mutations or very, very few mutations in the corn plants that were natural.
So like what kind of mutations did you observe for the casual, John Q. public
you
like
can
me?
You can do it with your kindergartner. Pollen grains have starch. Starch with iodine turns purple.
Okay.
All right. So you put the pollen grains on a slide. We put a low dose of iodine on it and we counted how many were purple and how many weren't. And you can do a mutation frequency. And it turned out that that's what we were able to do, that the pollen grains were mutating in their ability to deal with starch. We could detect it relatively easy in a glass slide. So we went ahead and did some studies. And basically what we found that these herbicides had all gone through the grass test,
right,
generally regarded as safe. There was no induction of any kind of tumors in animals or any reason to suspect it. That's because they weren't doing the metabolism in the same way a plant does the metabolism. And so what we found when we did all the chemistry and everything, that this particular category of pesticides was plant activated, meaning that a product was being produced by the plant, that when we isolated those products and tested them on other organisms, Ribola induced mutations. And that was the first discovery that, oh my gosh, you have to test these things on the plants themselves, because that's the food crop that's
right,
going in.
Right, right.
And so now we cut to all of these things like Roundup Ready or others. One really needs to do all of that work and all of that same kind of sensitivity to understand when you do these kinds of massive distributions of pesticides. We now know this whole process of plant activation occurs. And what does that mean relative to the grains that might come out and the use of those grains in feeds and everything else? And so it also means you can really clean a field by putting on extra doses of the herbicides.
So let's talk about what I call sometimes, and this is not insulting to anyone at all, but we all suffer from it. But scientists sometimes, particularly, it's like scientific myopia. You're looking at a particular thing, you're researching a particular issue, and what happens to this piece of corn. What about the integration of thought that I love to talk about with you, which is, so these pesticides, they're spraying them, where are they going? They're going into the ground. They are leaching into our water supply. There are documented, scientific, non-controversial documented, research documents about dead zones on the Mississippi River because of this. So what's your answer to that? Isn't that something that scientists in the United States need to be really integrating the thought and having the conversation, or are they? Is that a cheap shot on my part?
No, it's not. And I think that's one of the reasons, maybe, in fairness, why things like GMOs started to come about. Are there ways you can do genetic modifications
right.
that would reduce as opposed to enhance the amount of pesticides you could put out? Are there ways in which that we can grow? We need more food. Because the world is growing at a tremendous
rate.
So what are the safe ways of doing that? The limonados aside, we don't need that. That's a boutique thing that can happen. But are there ways? The Roundup Ready is a way you can use more pesticides to really clean a field. But are there ways you can use less pesticides? Are there ways in which you can enhance the productivity of what I would call organic farming? To be able to move it forward. I think that those are the kinds of directions. How can we also use plants to not just feed the world, but actually, to be honest with you, save populations in the world?
Because we're not going to get down to that. We're down to that, where populations are starving. I mean, it's one of those things where people wake up, watch the BBC news instead of the news in the United States, if you want to find out what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But the ball has started rolling. Agreed?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can take a look, for example, and again, just some examples of some GMOs that are really worth looking at and understanding how we can maybe take advantage of this.
Like the good guys.
These are some of the good guys, but these are also some of the challenges. So people are looking at potatoes, and they're actually being able to take aspects of the anti-cholera vaccines to put those into potatoes, so you get vaccinatos, if you
You're
want to
kidding.
Think about it. And what that might do then is, in the developing world, to actually be able to have a greater distribution of some positive elements that would help folks in a disease-infested area.
So literally, by eating the potato...
Potato would start giving you some of the protection...
Against cholera.
Against the cholera. And so that's a good thing. It's got a long way
That's
to go.
That's a really good thing.
It's got a long way to go, but it's the type of thing you can do with genetics and the type of things you can do. You can also make these tomatoes much more disease resistant so that they can grow in environments that might be more hostile to tomato growth relative to phytophthora infestations.
So it's the good fight. I mean, it's really the good fight to stay ahead of the hunger, the blights, and all that. And I cannot believe that we're going to have to take another break. I have this wonderful board op over here giving us the 1 minute warning. But let's talk a little bit more when we come back about that. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about pest management and have we oversimplified it? What it means for the small farmer. Let's come back and talk a little bit more about that and some big concerns about the big dogs, the corporate patenting of genetically modified crops. Everybody stay here with me. I'm having Whirling Dervish Brain. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at mrsgreensworld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at mrsgreensworld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@mrsgreensworld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World, next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green with some pretty impressive news about the VW Jetta TDI. It's got a turbocharged clean diesel engine. It's 90% cleaner than previous diesel engines. It gets 609 miles on one tank of gas, more than the Prius. That's from Tucson, Arizona to San Diego and halfway back. And it's got an amazing 6-speed Tiptronic transmission. See Chapman VW today for a very special offer on the 2014 Jetta TDI or visit ChapmanTucson.com.
We rely on your generosity for our inventory. Homeowners, renters, contractors, and business owners keep the Habit Store stocked with building supplies, furniture, and appliances. You can drop off your donations or give us a call at 889-7200 to schedule a free pickup of items that are in good condition. Your donations means Habitat Tucson can build and renovate more homes for hardworking people. The Habit Store's hours are Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, Saturday, 8 to 4, and you'll find us on Grant Road just east of I-10 in Tucson, Arizona.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and we hope that you have been able to follow our train of thinking and thought-provoking concepts that our guest today, Dr. Jim Gentile, is bringing to, you know, top of mind. The topic for our show is, what is a GMO and why should I care? To me, it is just... such a compelling reason for all of us to educate ourselves more about this topic. It's very much impacting small farmers, big farmers, our food supply, who's controlling that food supply. So a little bit more about Jim Gentile, and I'm not going to go into the very long kudos for Jim, but he deserves it. He is the Dean for the Natural and Applied Sciences at Hope College in Holland, Michigan, and the past president of Research Corporation for Science and Advancement based here in Tucson. And he is a geneticist by training, has conducted extensive research on the role of metabolism in the conversion of natural and xenobiotic agents. And, you know, I think you should tell us what that means, because, I mean, I do that long, great intro. And what does that mean? Let's start there. And then let's really go back to talking about, the GMO conversation of good versus evil and what kind of impact. We've got to get to what Jim Gentile really thinks. And is that an oversimplification? So what did you do?
xenobiotic just means non-biological. So something okay.
that's not a normal.
Yeah, it's a fancy
so
word.
So cerebral.
Yeah, so it's what you have to write to get NIH grants and
right.
things like that. And so it's really talking about chemicals that wouldn't normally be in the environment, and are there metabolic processes that might make them harmful or might make them even more beneficial than.
But so germane to the genetically, I mean, it is the genetically modified organism conversation, which is why I love spending hours talking to you about it.
It is. Yeah. So, all right.
Okay. So have at you. When we're talking about, we talked about lemonadas, we talked about the good parts of GMOs, when you're talking about cholera and preventing cholera. Where are we going with this? And what are the risk factors that need to be assessed when we're looking at I'm for them or I am against them? Or can that even be the conversation?
Well, I think it's a it's really tough. And when you think about things on a global scale versus a regional scale, and as much as it probably hurts all of us in the U.S., we are nothing but a region. It's tough. So golden rice might be a really good example.
Okay.
It's being used to fight vitamin A deficiency in individuals. Affects vitamin A deficiency globally is about 250 million individuals.
So what happens if someone has a vitamin A deficiency?
So they're going to get sick pretty easily, and they're going to have a variety of issues. One can take a look and understand one half of the world eats rice daily.
Every day.
One half of the world population. So if we can get beta carotene into those individuals, we can, through moving genes into rice, that will provide that beta carotene. It'll essentially provide the vitamin A that's necessary. Well, the rice take on a little bit of a yellow hue. That's where it comes out of the golden rice. And you can feed a huge number of individuals that way, and mitigate against a very large killing disease. To the best of my knowledge, we don't really have a downside on golden rice.
Right.
Except maybe price and things like that. But it doesn't really affect us in the U.S. as much. So we're sort of oblivious to it. And we don't pay attention that this is probably one of the winners. This is probably one of the kinds of things that you know, has been really effective.
And let me ask you this. I have to ask you this because I couldn't not pick on Monsanto a little bit. When it comes to that kind of research and that type of really plus for human beings, for the world, are they at the cutting edge of this research? Are they trying to do anything for the greater good of mankind? And I, you know that you and I have had many dinners, and I love to pick on them. I don't want to demonize them. Are they involved in some of the good fight, as long as they can figure out, see, here's my ding, their earnings per share piece and how to make a profit on it?
Yeah. You know, I think from my background, I come from a ethic that tells me 90% for me, 10% for the common good.
And, yes. There's the answer.
And I think that's what industry should be doing as well. I don't know if those percentages are right. Those
right.
Have, you know, in various ways. So I think it is doing some things for Monsanto and other organizations that do genetically modification is doing some things for the common good. But I think you have to go all the way when you do that. So if you're building things like golden rice, or you're putting genes into corn that will allow them to be more drought tolerant, for example, or to be able to be more salt tolerant in soils where there's a salty thing, I think what you have to do is allow those people then to take 10% for themselves,
right,
of their crop,
right,
and reuse it in the following year,
right,
rather than have to buy the crop every year. And so that's one of the kinds of things I think corporate America, and maybe universally corporate society, must take a look at. Is there's bad or good, we could probably have farmers in the U.S. that can afford to buy new seed every year and go through with that. And I understand that. Go back to our India story where farmers are committing suicide because they can't get enough out of their crop sales to be able to buy the money that would allow them to put in a new crop. And I think that's where I would really like to see, and I'm not picking on Monsanto, but I'm just talking about corporate.
In general, yes.
Corporations in general really need to make sure that they find ways of working with people, particularly in the developing world, and even working with people in some of the more impoverished areas of North America and South America, to actually be able to farm the old-fashioned way, as well as help them make a profit with the seeds that they're providing.
And I think you make such a good point, because it's be careful. My caution would be to people listening is be careful just looking at Monsanto, because there are other companies
Absolutely.
That are big time on board with genetically engineering crops and genetic modification. And let's it's that integration of thought concept. What about the like other big dogs, for example, that could really turn the needle in a very different direction? For example, big purchasers. The largest purchaser of crops in the world is Walmart, okay? So if they take a stand, which in some cases they're putting affordable organic things like organic milk, a lot of families could not afford it if it wasn't that, or, you know, Walmart said, or their customer said, we demand this. Can they help in terms of the big corporate movement to move us in a healthier direction, not just for our bodies, but for the planet? That, how's that for a long question?
Yeah, it's a long question, but so I would say it probably comes down to the same situation.
90-10?
Well, 90-10 a little bit, but and this is just me off the top of my head because I didn't expect a Walmart question. I would rather see Walmart reduce the prices of the food because that's going to affect human health.
Right.
And increase the prices of their sweatshirts. Or
yes.
all of the
oh
other kinds
God,
of things.
Oh my God, that's a great answer.
And come out in a balance such that they could really be doing a human good by providing food at lower prices than might be a organic food store in a neighborhood, but make up their profit differential in other ways. And once you have people at a Walmart, you're going to buy. When I go to a Walmart, I wind up buying a lot of stuff I didn't expect to buy.
Right.
And that's going to happen, and it'll be a benefit. So if an organization such as that might be able to envision a balanced profit mechanism where they're having different kinds of commodities that aren't urgent for life, as well as foods, take the hit in foods and make it up elsewhere.
And they can still make their bottom line. And I think it's a dangerous conversation sometimes when you really think about it a little more deeply to say just bluntly state that organic is more expensive, because I had someone on from the Environmental Working Group. They did a long-term study about how to eat healthier, more affordably. And what this woman pointed out is that even with a very, very limited budget, it is about choices. So you can buy organic and not have your kids or yourself have a latte, which, you know, that's a fringe that
that's
a
right.
lot of people don't have. But there's the, you can invest in healthy food so that your children are healthier, so that you're healthier. So ostensibly, the it's more expensive argument could be knocked out if we all ate healthier. Healthcare costs, missing school, missing work, it's all, a lot of it is connected to a healthy diet. Agreed?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially when you think about allergens in foods and the kinds of things that are occurring, sometimes going back to a base food that's unmodified in any way, shape, or form is a good way of starting to understand where those allergens are coming from, what people might be reacting to, and where things might go. I personally tend to do my shopping for foods,
right?
Whole foods,
right?
I do my shopping for non-foods at Walmart.
Right, right.
And I keep my balance that way, as opposed to going to boutique stores. And so I do boutique food, if one wants to think about it that way.
Right,
and
right.
You pay a little bit of a premium, but you can make it up in other areas in your life.
You really
life.
Can. That's my point. You can really make sacrifices and choices in other ways.
Right, and that's why I think you're questioning about an organization such as a Walmart or Meijer's Thrifty Acres back in Michigan, or the kinds of places
right.
can make those same kind of choices. We're going to provide this kind of healthy food product. And yet we're going to have a balance when people come into a megastore and they go through it. We're going to have a balance to actually be able to still meet our bottom line and have all of our investors happy.
And I want to go back to one conversation and make sure that we really make it clear on this show, because you and I went to dinner or lunch or something, and I couldn't wait because I wanted you to tell me all the reasons why, if I eat genetically modified foods, it's going to hurt me, it's going to harm me, it's going to make me sick. And in fact, you did not do that. So just very clearly, inherently, a genetically modified food, when you see non-GMO, 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 is that it's not inherently bad. That's what you said to me. It will not harm my body just because it's been genetically modified.
Absolutely correct.
I think that's really important for people to understand, because I wanted you to tell me, oh my God, Gina, I hope you never eat another genetically modified organism in your life, and good luck with finding food that isn't.
Right. And I think what one needs to think about then is going back to the comment that I made earlier, it all depends on the genes you're moving.
Right.
And what for.
What you're messing with.
So, for example, people are playing around now with a rubber cork tree. So that the bark will have the same consistency of the corks that are in stoppers and fine wine.
Because God knows we don't want to get rid of those.
Right. But that means that we're also not now taking all of that rubber and we have now a different kind of a ref. We have made organic rubber in that kind of a sense. And we have the same ability to save wine with those kinds of things. The paper tree in some areas where in the developing world, where now trees have been modified to have some leaves in some of these trees, not in the wild or anything,
right.
Trees you would grow, to have actually square leaves that blanch and have fiber in them. You can take them off and you can actually write on them.
You're kidding.
So that
such saves, a good example.
That saves, in many cases, going to tree farms, and which are occupying a lot of land and disrupting everything by scrambling those trees and turning it into paper and stuff. So there's some movement that are going. It sounds silly and it sounds small, but it goes into, to be honest with you, making a greener environment.
Really important. I mean, and paper shortages. I mean, that's
absolutely
just huge. I tell people, really be careful about it because we don't want to be toilet paper deficient. Nobody wants to do it without their toilet paper.
Yeah.
And it really is getting to the point where it's something we have to look at. Paper towel use, all of the napkins in restaurants. So anyway, so a genetically modified food is not going to necessarily hurt me. It matters how you move the gene. I think people really get that. And that's what I wanted you to be able to articulate.
Sure. I'll give you one of my favorites. You know, I'm a fisher person. And I love salmon fishing. I love to go to Alaska and go for the wild salmon. But I want to protect those wild salmon stocks.
Right,
I don't want
right.
to see them commercially fished. So what they're doing now is inserting genes in these farmed salmon, so that you really have a new crop of salmon without affecting the environmental crop that's necessary to keep salmon as one of the kings of the ocean.
And that's a good thing.
That's a good thing, because otherwise we would start using net trapping and. Particularly up in the areas of Alaska, the wild salmon stock are slower breeders, and we could eliminate an organism from the face of the earth on that. So there's different kinds of trade-offs that we want to make and different ways of thinking about it. And the only thing I could say, though, a farm salmon is nowhere near as tasty as a wild salmon, but it does satisfy the kind of the great salmon need that we find in everything from dog food.
And you don't
want to
eliminate the thrill of the fishing trip, which
that's right.
My brother has epic stories about his wild salmon fishing in Alaska. I mean, there's this goes back again to what I call the integration of thought. So we have 2 minutes. Do you have a takeaway for listeners? I think you do, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
No, you tell me what
I think it is that what you said so clearly is, really do more research. People have to think more. There's so much information readily available to us. I think one of the takeaways for me from what you said is Google both sides of the argument and take a look at what are some of the studies. Who's funding the studies? Just that alone. Did Monsanto pay for this scientific research that the government came out with? I mean, those kinds of things that are, let us become deeper thinkers about these issues.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think one should be cautious about what you put in your mouth, each of us individually.
Right, right.
We should be cautious about what comes out of our mouth as well.
It's really important because I just said it. We are what we eat. That's been the article, the newsletter topics. We are what we eat. And one of them I wrote about 4 years ago, it said, and I am not a GMO, but I've learned because to know better is to do better. Everybody, thank you from the bottom of my heart, Dr. Jim Gentile. Tuesday at 7, Down to Earth, Jared McKinley, associate publisher of Edible Baja, and next Saturday, Judith Curry, who is known as the climate heretic. You're going to want to be here for that one. Everybody, make it a great green week. Happy New Year. And thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.